Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman. On this episode, Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com, and myself going to talk a lot of your questions about the season and obviously the transfer portal, which I think is probably, you know, first and foremost in everyone's mind at this point, I feel like. Even though the national title game is tomorrow night. And I honestly, like, it could be at some point fun it will be very fun to answer your questions, our Patreon questions. And as I told the Patreons, the way we're going to do this show is our Patreons ask the questions, we answer them. We release it as a podcast, but our Patreons get all their questions answered. So sort of Patreon only. Access to the question process as opposed to normal Twitter. But first, I want to get my dude Eric Fawcett's thoughts on the national title game. The two best teams all year, tomorrow night.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of when this happens, when the teams that are the best end up standing at the end. I do think that's definitely the case here. I don't think it was the best Final Four. So it's just that's kind of probably the best kind of mix. You do want some kind of randomness. That's what people love about a single elimination bracket. But I do definitely want the best team standing. And I mean, hey, like, we got a couple snoozers in the Elite Eight and you know, one not very good one in the Final Four because of some, you know, Cinderella teams or whatever you want to call it. I know North Carolina State, probably not something you want to call a Cinderella, but you know what I mean. But yeah, I think that UConn and Purdue are definitely the two best teams in the country. I think that UConn is playing a different sport than everyone else, and I think is going to dominate. And I think that there is, like, in such a copycat world, I'm surprised that there is not more people that look at UConn absolutely dominating everyone this year with, like, good but not overwhelming talent. I don't think anyone looks at this UConn team and is like, well, they're just way more talented than everyone and they're just absolutely bulldozing people, and it's because they run a set every time down the floor and run way better offense than anyone in college basketball has ever seen and are absolutely dominating people because of it. So I'll be curious if they win. Some people are probably going to listen to this podcast after this game even happens, who knows, but I think UConn's going to dominate, and just like they've dominated this entire season and this entire tournament, and they're doing it playing a style that I'm surprised has not been talked about more as something that should be replicated. I think it's going to be very interesting, but everything I stand for in the game of basketball is represented by UConn. So I would like to see them win, continue the kind of dominance that they've had. And that would be my prediction. I think I saw Ken Pom had it like 6 points or something, or maybe that was the Vegas line, which I know is pretty big for a national championship. I see from the people that are into betting, but I still think this could be another situation where UConn's just winning everything by double figures. I think what they're doing is incredible. I know some people won't want that to happen listening because they want Florida to stand as the team. I'll be interested actually what your thought on this is, but I know people would love for Florida to have had that record forever, or record, the most recent team that's won back-to-back championships. I totally understand that, but at least if there is a team that is going to win back-to-back championships and take it away from the Gators, I hope that people, Florida fans, can say, hey, at least like this was no, like this they didn't cheat this. They were absolutely dominant in last year's tournament. They didn't have a dominant season, but they had an absolutely dominant tournament. And this year they had an absolutely dominant season and appear to be having an absolutely dominant tournament. So at least it's not a situation where you're like, wow, like, you know, things really, if they end up winning, at least it's not a situation where you're like, man, that sucks. The team took away Florida's reigning title as back-to-back championships and they got lucky with matchups or had a couple bounces go their way. Like, hey, at least UConn will have done it ethically, for lack of a better term, ethical buckets. Just running offense at an extremely high level, playing extremely connected, and just like never faltering. Like they, like this entire tournament, they've never been tested. So at least I hope for people who are like, oh, I hate this, don't want UConn to win, want Florida to have the most, you know, reigning back-to-back titles. Hey, at least if it happens, I think this is a team that you should be At least you'd be like, okay, well, you know, UConn did this. They earned this one.
Totally. I mean, they like you said, they rolled to the Final Four without really being pushed at all. The Alabama game was tied with, 8 minutes to go. So they, you know, certainly were pushed a little bit by Alabama, but they still won by getting pushed for you. This UConn team is winning by 14, which is the way that they just, as soon as Alabama tied the game, the way that they just went on that immediate, 8-0 run in 40 seconds, just gives you an idea of, just how spectacular they are. And, I get it. And I asked a question yesterday, and it really was just to see how many people were pulling for Cinderella, because the NC State story was really amazing. And I did kind of think they were a Cinderella, even though they were from the ACC. And I also thought it because, the ACC was disrespected all year, even by people that write about it to some extent. spent a lot of time in my columns making fun of the league and got some grief for it. And then obviously the ACC had a good tournament, a good tournament. And, you know, maybe I should have looked closer at some head-to-head stuff and less at the computer analytics and realized that, hey, the ACC had a winning record against the Mountain West, and the ACC was 11-3 against the – or 9-3 in the regular season against the Big 12, and they tied the ACC-SEC Challenge. Maybe I should have realized that. But to me, NC State was still Cinderella, because even if you think the ACC was good, NC State went 9-11 in the ACC, and then they just won 9 consecutive games with some guy who, I remember – texting Eric about when I went to a Winthrop game a couple years ago and being like, they got this guy, DJ Burns, and he's kind of an interesting player to watch. It's very unique because he's huge and he doesn't really jump, but he's got, insanely soft hands and skill. And anyway, it was fun. It was fun to watch them. And honestly, I thought they played pretty hard against Purdue. You just spent a lot of time on UConn. So let me spend some time on Purdue. They held Purdue to their season low in field goal percentage. They held them to, I think it was their second lowest points per possession. They showed up and played hard. They just lost and still lost by 13 because Purdue can just lock you down, man. With Edie on the inside, and then Lance Jones is not a good offensive player by any stretch of the imagination. Really. He hit a big three yesterday. But not a great offensive player at all, but a really solid defender. And then I think Fletcher Lawyer is a guy who can keep you in front, sort of like Cam Spencer can keep you in front. You look at him and you don't think that guy's a great defensive player, but he's a pretty steady defensive guard, honestly. And I'm not sure there's a guy in the Final Four that's improved more than Braden Smith. I believe that take. Because I kept hearing all year, Purdue, they lost a Farley Dickinson and they're not quite as good. And it's every metric, every analytical measure, if you go to Torvik, if you go to KenPom, if you go to Evan Maya, if you just look at ESPN.com and compare stats, Braden Smith is so much better than he was last season. And they're a program that doesn't really do things totally in the portal. So, and then they have Zach Edey, who's just, you talk about a player who has improved. I remember when Florida went down and played them at the PK80, or Florida went out to the PK80 where Purdue was, rather. And, we were previewing the PK80 on this podcast, and we talked about how they had this guy, Zach Edey, who was just kind of an interesting phenomenon. We weren't sure how skilled he was, and, ends up winning 2 Wooden Awards. So I love this. I think UConn's going to win. I think they've had the best team all season. I think they run the best stuff. I think they have 3 front court players who are capable of just kind of sort of like Florida went at Greg Oden in waves in 2007. UConn can do that with Samson Johnson and with Klingon and I think Carabon is kind of a jack of all trades big, but he can get down there and battle if he has to. I also think Klingon is better than people think when he gets away from the basket. So if that's going to be Purdue's strategy to some extent, pull him away, and force Edie to battle with other people, I think that'll be, they'll be fine in that regard. So, You know, and then I think UConn's guards are just so much better than Purdue's. Like, I know I just said a lot of nice things about Braden Smith, and I believe them. But, like, I think Tristan Newton and Cam Spencer are just so much better. And that's before we even get to Stephen Castle, who just played out of his mind against Alabama. So I would be very surprised if UConn didn't win. And you know what? It's okay. Like, Florida fans, I'll do one better. Like, I think Eric's right. Like, you could say, if you're a Florida fan and you're upset about it, I get it. I also think you could say, hey, like, at least it was a super dominant team that just rolled through a couple tournaments and was just clearly better. And then there's the backstory. Like, you saw in The Athletic this week, for those of you that read, like, Danny Hurley consulted with Billy Donovan, his friend, and asked him, like, for pointers and you know, what do you do? Talk to Joakim Noah about, like, how to kind of approach it mentally after they lost to Creighton in the middle of February. And Hurley thought, man, we just thought, I think they had beaten Marquette by like 30 the day before, or not the day before, but that week. And they rolled out to Creighton and just got walloped. And Danny Hurley was like, I think we just thought, like, how good, oh, look at how good we are. And after that, they kind of rallied and they haven't lost since, haven't looked back since. And, you know, Florida fans will remember Florida having a couple games in the middle of February in their repeat year where they look kind of disinterested and tired of defending the title. And they found their way through it and won, and really weren't pushed. They weren't quite as scoreboard dominant as this UConn team. But with the exception of the second round game against Purdue, Florida wasn't really challenged in their run to a second straight title. They all the other five games were fairly lopsided. I think they trailed Ohio State 9-5. So, like, that was it. And then it was pretty much wire to wire in that game as well. Yeah, I don't know, but I'm looking forward to watching. I think it's certainly intriguing. And man, Zach Edey's awesome. Like, it's fun to watch. I disagree with the people that are like, he's good. So, like, in addition to being 7'8" and somewhat unfair, like, he's also really good.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. Like, while I really want UConn to win, because, to be honest with you, because they represent everything that I like in basketball and what so many more coaches should aspire to have their teams play. Don't really love the Hurley demeanor necessarily, but the way that his teams play, like, again, it's just laughable to me that they're running a set every time down the floor and running intricate offense, and we still have, like, coaches that are considered good being like, oh, we just want to pass and cut and play out of concepts. Like, well, you just lost to UConn by 30. Like, it's just like, is UConn's talent really all that overwhelming? I don't think so.
Yeah.
They have good players. Don't get me wrong. They've got first round picks. Don't get me wrong. But it's just like, they are playing a different, like, again, like, I truly, like, they are playing a different sport than everyone in college basketball. Cause we have guys that are, like, trying to play ball screen continuity,
right,
while UConn is running seven layers deeper. And it's just like, it's just stunning to me that just overall, there's not more copycat conversation of like, oh, like, if you're going to be an elite program, like, this is what you need to do. But
yeah,
we'll see. Those conversations will come. But or what I was going to say was, so that's why I want UConn to win. But at the same time, I would love to see the people that just hate Zach Edey just furious if Purdue wins. That would make for some good content for sure. But who knows? We might still have some. Maybe for a different offseason podcast, we talk a little bit more about takeaways, style of play, about the way that, what we learned from the NCAA tournament. We talked about some guards. Pretty sure Florida's guards were just about as good as anyone's in the country, and they went home in round of 64. So maybe that's a little bit more the dog days of summer conversation about what there all is to be about that. But I'd be happy to get into questions if you'd like.
Yeah, man, I think there's a lot to get into on that. And maybe we'll get the chance to get into that this summer. Maybe we won't. I certainly hope that those conversations are had on this podcast in one form or another. That's all I'll say to folks. And I promise that they will be. I'll be here. So, hey, that's all I got on that. You know, and I will say, I'm going to pat myself on the back and we'll get to Patreons. It was funny because you just kind of took a fun shot at Brad Underwood. And I wrote an article Monday, and it was interesting to see, like, the UConn fans that know the sport and then the ones that don't know the sport as well and are just kind of like, yeah, UConn. So I wrote an article about how, like, I felt like Alabama's just backcourt depth and the way that they space to kind of free up driving lanes and then drive and kick and get shooters open was going to be something that they hadn't, that UConn hadn't seen much of, right? Like, Shaka Smart, they don't run particularly great offense, Marquette, in my opinion. Creighton runs good stuff, but like, they hadn't seen, Creighton didn't have nearly the guard depth that Alabama had, right? And so, like, I wrote this article and I just said, hey, I'm not saying UConn's going to win, or I'm not saying Alabama's going to win. I'm saying that, like, there's a formula where Alabama, that game is interesting for a while. And I got all this, oh, well, you know, you just mentioned Taryn Shannon being one of the only players ranked higher than Mark Sears and Parr, and look what happened there. And I was like, respectfully, can we not compare what Nate Oates does on offense to what Brad Underwood does? And we saw, like, you know, and, you know, those that think this Alabama run was a fluke, maybe there's some merit to that. But then again, there's the points that Eric and I have made on the podcast all year where, like, when you are that historically good on offense, the only outcome has been the Final Four now for yet another team. So, seriously, the seven teams that have finished with Alabama's offensive rating have all gone to the Final Four in the last 10 years, every single one of them. Alabama just didn't guard great, but they guarded better in the NCAA tournament, and look where they ended up. Patreon questions. We are in business on this as soon as I get this up, and we have a lot of them. So this should be super fun. I swear it's loading, Eric. Okay, here we go. We are underway. Robert Kipping, thank you for your patronage. He said, looking to next year's roster build, you have to assume a downgrade in playmaking at point guard, given Zion Pullen's outstanding performance. Jordan Pope has emerged as a popular potential portal target in places like Malik's Twitter's chat. We miss you, Eric. It seems the idea would be to offset some of that loss with improved shooting and finishing. While that makes some sense, especially in considering the staff's pre-Zion pursuit of Perry, I wonder if elite playmaking creation at point guard will be more valuable or essential within the framework of our offense. Any thoughts?
I think Florida needed people who could go get you one. I don't think Florida has some complex offense where there's guys coming off screens that need a point guard that can get someone on time and on target. And again, I've thrown my stones at Florida's offense, and that was not a jab right there. It's just we saw that they preferred guys who could go and get you one and change the score individually. And I don't know. Like, again, if you take Florida Andrew Nembhard and put him in the Zion Pullen role, would it have been as good of a season? I don't think so. And that's not to say that I think Zion Pullen's necessarily a better player than Andrew Nembhard. It's just like style wise. I think it was Pullen's ability to get in the paint and hold a dribble and distribute from there more than like someone who's like your conventional point guard distributor. So like, I unless Florida is going to change the way they play, and again, there's still so many ways the roster could go. So like, it's possible they go for someone who's a little bit more of your like traditional pass first distributor at that position. But yeah, I kind of think they should, if they're looking like offensively, I think they probably or should look for something similar and someone that's like a little bit more of a paint touch guy and can make something happen individually. But yeah. And you know, I know Jordan Pope's a very popular name. Yeah, I don't know. I understand it to an extent. I think there are some empty calories there for sure. Oregon State, obviously just not winning a lot of games. Not a team that played particularly cohesively. I'm intrigued by Jordan Pope. I know he is like the biggest name everyone's looking for. I am not totally sold on that. But yeah, I can understand like he put up points in a tough situation, and I know a lot of people can look at that and say like, oh well, if he was at Florida, you know, things would be a lot better. So yeah, and that's obviously a huge position for the Gators point guard. A lot of ways that they could go, but yeah, I don't know. Like I don't look at the way that Florida played last year and was thinking like, oh, they could use someone who's more of a, you know, prototypical distributor in this offense. I think they were like, hey, they've got two guys that can get in the paint and score. And if that's going to be, if Walter Clayton's around again, I think you get another score next to him and see what happens.
Yeah, I agree. I've been telling people, I think the intrigue with Pope is that he can win battles off the bounce. And like Flores, Kuliga, I think they need it. Really good guard play. Guards that can score is what I mean by that in their offensive system. And to that end, because I know we talked a lot about, well, we didn't talk as much about it, but certainly the program like to flout the assist to turnover ratio or pull and lead the country. And I think his assist rate obviously was very high, the highest for Florida since Wilbekin. So out actually better than Chioza each of his years, I think, each of his junior and senior years. So a lot of discussion points about that. And like Kyle Lofton was very good at that, right? Like his assist to turnover ratio was 3.5 to 1.2. So we've kind of seen like what happens in the Todd Golden offense when it's just a distribute first point guard. And like it just doesn't work very well. Like Florida finished outside of the top 100 in offensive efficiency for the first time this century in that scenario. And they did so with three guys that played NBA basketball games this season on their roster. So, or is it two? Fudge, Castleton, am I forgetting someone? In any event, I think it was two NBA guys and you know, just kind of surprising to me that that's where all that ended up. So I think Florida has to get somebody that can get their own bucket. What I will say about Pope is like numbers wise, you can point to the system if you want, but you know, certainly behind Pullen in offensive rating, their usage rates actually are kind of similar, which I thought was pretty interesting. You know, relatively speaking, they're both above 20, of course, and one at 26 is higher than Walter Clayton's, but I think at Florida it would be lower and down towards the Pullen range. But yeah, not totally comparable. I'm not totally sold on the production being similar. I think there'd be a drop off in production, but he's still the kind of player that I think can get you bucket off the bounce. Colin Chapman asked, what would be more important this year, a 3-and-D wing, attacking point guard, or a true power forward? I think it's Florida has to start with guards that can score, because that's got to be look, Walter Clayton's going to go out there and not guard a lot. He's going to go out there and score some points. And I think Florida has a chance to, again, use the portal to build a sensational backcourt and then go from there. And I also think Florida can expect some defensive improvement as Houck and Condon mature.
Yeah, like I think the question is maybe as easy as like you can imagine the team winning without a true power forward. I'm not saying this is for sure. This is fine. Like you'd want all the three things mentioned, but like you can envision a world where they don't have a true power forward and they win. You can envision a situation where they don't have a big wing and still are a good team and win. It's pretty hard to imagine not having a really good point guard and winning. So to me, it's got to be that position. And if you wanted to say, oh, that player is Walter Clayton, possibly, you know, maybe the staff could see him as someone who could be the full-time point guard. I don't think that's where he'd be best, but he's obviously a very good player. So even out of position, still going to bring a lot of value there. But I think you've got to look at the point guard as being the most important. Like certainly that is not to say that those other things wouldn't be great. Big wing to help the defense would be great. Power forward that can guard, that would really help Florida's offense, or Florida's defense. Those are two important things too. But it's just like, yeah, there's teams out there that win playing three guards. There's teams out there who play a small ball four and can win. There's just not many teams that out there without really, really good point guard play winning. So that would be kind of my, and I guess just to say, if I had to, I just because it's pretty clear it's point guard for me, I would say the second most important, I would say I would say probably a good player at the power forward spot. While big wings are amazing, there's just so few of them. And if it's like you can take away the position of a big wing, and if you put a really good guard in that position, you're still going to be pretty good. Whereas if you don't have a good player at the power forward spot and you're just suddenly either play a center in that position or a not very good undersized player, you're going to have issues. So I would love a big wing for Florida. You can just work around that a little bit more than the power forward spot, where I do think Florida would have looked a lot better in a lot of situations this year if they had someone who was a more conventional power forward.
Yeah, I think that's good stuff. And I think, you got to wait, see maybe if Florida really has a shot at the Wizard Twins. Obviously, there's the possibility that a power forward reclassifies and Florida could maybe add, certainly would be a young player, but a very talented freshman to the roster to kind of fill that void. Cooper Curry with a good question said, you and Eric both mentioned the vanilla defensive scheme, which caused Florida to struggle against Colorado and at other times throughout the season. What do you mean by this? Are there actual schematic problems that you make Florida's defense inadequate in your mind?
Yeah, I think that, and again, there's, when I say like vanilla defense, it's not even necessarily like a problem in that scenario, which is kind of funny, because if I said someone's offense was vanilla, I'd probably mean it as an insult. But when I say it as a defense, it's more just what I really should have said. Vanilla is really actually not a great word for it. I should have just said like, and I know I have to use this word, but it's just conservative. Playing that kind of drop pick and roll coverage where you're not going to be disruptive. You're not going to take a team out of what they're trying to do. The extreme example being like Houston, like if you watch Houston play, every action, they're extremely aggressive. They trap pick and roll. So they're trying to take teams like out of their pick and roll offense entirely. They're trying to deny ball reversals, take teams out of their offense entirely. Whereas Florida is a team that, plays fairly conservatively in all things. They don't challenge in the gap. So in order to not give away one pass away threes. So of course, everything in basketball defensively is like you're going to give something up always. So Florida chooses to, Florida chooses to be pretty conservative and they don't want to give up threes. So they're not going to help in the drive. So when guys were driving around Florida's guards and there wasn't anyone in the gap to dig down and help, that's just what they're willing to give up. To play drop, pick and roll, they were going to allow guards to get to the middle of the floor and try to make plays. And but Florida was going to try to take away the rim with their drop. And they were going to try to take away off the dribble threes by chasing over the top of the dribble. So, or with the ball handler defender. So, and then I think that what I really meant by vanilla is just the fact that Florida just never changed anything. They didn't have like, okay, they like experimented with icing side ball screens, which is essentially like the near cousin of drop pick and roll coverage in the middle of the floor. They obviously, people always said, oh, like, will they play zone? Like, no, they will never play zone. Or I shouldn't say they will never, but like at the end of the season, when people are like, oh, they should play zone, it's like, well, something Todd Golden's never done. So like they did hard hedge pick and rolls a little bit at San Francisco. So they mixed in playing hard hedge and dropping, but like we haven't seen that in Florida. So so vanilla probably wasn't the right word other than vanilla in the sense that there's just no variety to it. And when Florida's having issues, it just didn't seem like they were able to make any changes because they didn't have a more aggressive pick and roll defense. They didn't go from playing more of the pack line to, or they didn't have a situation where they went from taking away passes to like, oh, we're going to sit higher in the gaps, or, oh, we're going to play back line and help one pass. Like there just was no variation to it. And and I just think that's something that hurt them a little bit. And again, when the question is there anything schematically wrong with Florida's defense? No, I actually really, so people who've listened to this podcast for years will remember that I spent years saying that Florida under Mike White should be dropping pick and rolls. So, and guarding them the exact way that Florida's base coverage is now. So believe me, I do not, there's nothing structurally wrong with that. There's just times where they need to, I would say you need to be able to have a change up to your fastball. Or an off-speed pitch.
Right.
And there are just no changes. And Florida just became such an easy team to scout and such an easy team to play against. I don't think I don't think schematically there was any issues other than you would just hope that there was variation and there wasn't any.
Yeah, and I think when Florida talks about, like, when Todd Golden talks about needing someone to anchor his defense to the press, like, I think he's hinting that he's not going to really adjust too much from, like, what they want to do as, like, core concepts. And so I do think that's kind of what I mean by vanilla, is Florida has a base defense. It does not change very much. I also think when Florida iced ball screens against good offensive teams, and the rare instances that they did that, they got murdered because, you know, the ice ball screen action is sort of a 2015 or 16 thing to do. And well, even if it's a little, even if that's like maybe a little harsh, like certainly ever since like Nick Nurse just obliterated the Celtics, iced ball screens 3 or 4 years ago. Eric would probably know better than me when that was. I think it was 3 seasons ago at this point. But like, once the Raptors showed the world like how to destroy that particular type of screen defense, that was it. Like it was out in basketball circles, and people knew how to counter it. And when Florida did it, it was fairly easy to counter. And when people did it to Florida, by the way, like Florida countered it pretty well. This season, unless like Walter Clayton dribbled off his leg or something, like things went pretty well for the Gators against that particular coverage. So I think Florida just doesn't do things complicated. And I think, the biggest thing for Florida is like, who's your defensive anchor going to be? It's why it's encouraging to see them going after people like Mari Williams in the transfer portal, and not just relying on like a big jump from Alex Kahn, and like, let's go get somebody that is going to be sort of the anchor to make our base defense really good. Cause I think schematically what doing that is pretty sound. It's much sounder than some of the things Florida was doing under Mike White. And we saw that with like how Kavarius Hayes covered up like 3 years of sins for Florida. And then when he was gone, Florida's efficiency numbers decreased on defense every season. And I remember asking Mike about it in a postseason press conference. And Mike was like, yeah, I was looking at that today and trying to figure out what's been going on. And I was like, oh, boy. Like, you know, so I don't think I think Florida schematically is fine. I just think, you know, and I got some of this wrong, too. Like, Florida's just personnel wasn't good enough to necessarily do that all the time without some moderation. And again, we saw it in the NCAA tournament, right, when Florida threw a wrinkle at Colorado, who had one ball handler, and their trap was able to work. And maybe that you could say that's desperation, but certainly like, you know, it was just, hey, here they made an in-game adjustment that happened to do some good. Neil Lammers asks, any news on staff changes, anybody leaving or adding someone new? Do you think Florida will be put in the middle of the SEC like last year? So on the last one, I would guess, I mean, it's going to depend on the portal. I can't say right now where Florida would go in the SEC. I imagine they'll get a little bit of a bump because they just made the NCAA tournament and then they beat Alabama a couple times. So like Alabama went to the Final Four, and I think the media that don't know basketball as well might overreact to that, or overreact to like Walt Clayton coming back and Alex Kahn coming back. So, you know, I don't know, but we'll have to see the final rosters before I can fully answer that question. I don't expect any changes on the staff. It looks like Harlan Hartman was a candidate for the Rice job and ultimately is going to be back at Florida. So I don't think that there will be any staff changes so long as Todd Golden is the head coach at Florida.
Certainly conversations with those names. I thought that Hubday was going to get some looks at some of those jobs, particularly in the Northeast. So it's still like there's probably still some sneaky movement to be had in the carousel. So you never know. But I think that at least with the assistants, Florida, I'll say, survived the first round of them. Again, I'm sure that everyone would be happy if some of these guys got head jobs. But at the same time, it's Golden's probably secretly happy that some of the, or you know, outwardly happy to some extent that some of these guys returned. When you're dealing with so many players in the portal and rebuilding roster, having to worry about who you're going to hire staff wise is not particularly fun, to be honest with you. And it's nice to have a full roster of assistant coaches when you're attacking the portal, just for like able bodies to make calls. So yeah, Florida maybe got a little bit lucky in that situation. And that's also why, like, it's insane that Alabama made a Final Four with losing a couple of players to the NBA draft that they didn't expect to lose, and then losing like three assistants and going through the portal season, like down all their assistants. Yeah, but that's just, that's different conversation. But yeah, I think Alabama, Alabama getting to the Final Four is really crazy. And they had their issues in the portal because they didn't have a full staff for much of it. But yeah, so yeah, no, we'll see what happens with the carousel. Won't sleep for a little while overall in college basketball.
That's right. We sleep when the portal closes. Jarrett asked, do you think anyone other than Kugel will leave? And how do you see Brown and Ryu fitting into the roster for next season? No, I don't think Florida's going to lose anybody else. I still am like a little surprised Walt Clayton hasn't like tossed up the, you know, checking on my eligibility, retaining my eligibility, entering my name in the NBA draft Insta post yet, but I think it's coming. And then, yeah, I don't think anyone else is going to depart. I see Zay Brown as being a guy that they get on the floor some early in the season and see what he can do. You know, I do think Todd will play you if you can help. I mean, we saw that this year to his credit. I do not think Olivier Rieu is going to play for Florida at all next year. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say at all. He'll play probably in garbage time against somebody. But, yeah, he's a significant project, and I would anticipate a developmental redshirt.
Yeah, there's just a event like a all-Canadian game where here in Canada where all the top 2024 and 2025 players were playing. Rieu was there. I mean, like, he is – like the size is just like truly something to behold. Like he is just like, he's significantly bigger than Zach Edey, and Zach Edey just like
he's 7'4"
next to DJ Burns made DJ Burns look like Dante Bassett. So like, it's just like, it's the size is like truly just, it's spectacular. But it is like, he moves so poorly. And again, I don't like, that is nothing like, I just like, I think that is just the physiology of being a giant. So, he is literally going to be like, if you, and I say this only half jokingly, like he might be twice as slow as anyone in the entire SEC. Like, I know the game is not played in sprints, but if you did a sprint to one end of the court and back, I think he might get lapped. Like, I think people might be able to do it twice before he can do it once. And there's maybe some guards that could do it three. Like, he's such a load that, and that's not even talking about, and obviously the game is not played in sprints, but like, that is going to be a problem if Florida's playing the first 8 seconds of each possession, 4-on-5, because he's got to get back and get into the paint defensively. And that has nothing to do with even the fact that like, he's got to change directions. And if Todd Golden doesn't want to play zone, then you got to figure out something with what you're going to do with this guy defensively.
Right.
So, hey, if you're going to like with a preferred walk-on slot, like, yeah, go get the 7-8 guy. Like, believe me, I'm not saying like,
totally.
This is 100 times out of 100, take this guy with you with a preferred walk-on spot. But, yeah, I would not expect him to be on the floor, except for what would be like perhaps the loudest the Rowdies have ever cheered when he goes to check in at the end of a blowout game, because, you know, he will be somewhat of a sideshow, for better or for worse. Yeah, I think also Florida staff's probably looking at Zach Edey and say, hey, if we got a guy who can be 60% of Zach Edey by the time his eligibility is done, I mean, 60% of Zach Edey would be like, everyone would sign up for that. So, don't hold out hope. But, and if you want, you can probably, right. you probably search for some all-Canadian highlights. That was just last week. And you might see some Olivier Rieu stuff, which is certainly like worth seeing, because it is just like, it is, looks like a glitch on your TV.
Cooper Curry, to add on to my question from earlier, Cooper asks, what ways can Golden improve as a coach? And I will read that with another question, which came from Thomas Williams, because it's similar. And Thomas asked, in today's college game, and thank you both Cooper and Thomas for your support and patronage. Thomas's question, in today's games, what are a few specific ways that a coach proves himself in game Golden's had five seasons under his belt as a head coach, with the last two seasons being obviously closely examined by you all. Can you assess some of his proficiencies and deficiencies as an in-game coach? Well, I mean, I like that he has an idea of how he wants to play. I would say that's probably his biggest proficiency in my mind. Well, you know what? I'll say that's his second. Well, okay, just sticking to in-game coaching. I think the idea of how he wants to play is probably the biggest proficiency, and like the willingness to go out and correct it. And then that spills over to like an off-court issue of evaluations, which I think the staff has shown themselves to be quite good at early on. But I would also say, like, from a deficiency standpoint, like, I think timeout usage was the most egregious this season to me. And then sort of we already talked a little bit about the lack of sort of defensive adjustments. Those weren't great. I will say Florida's, I didn't look at the synergy numbers before the show, and I should have, but I feel like Florida's after timeout offense was pretty good this season. And I know it's, at one point I had looked at it, Eric, and it was much improved from last year. Now, how much of that is what Florida did after timeouts and what Todd drew up, and how much of it was like, hey, Walter Coit and Zion Pullen are just really good? I don't know, but I'll stick with my proficiency answer. And, you know, I say, I do think Todd could manage games better with his timeout usage.
Yeah, I think that the after timeout stuff was good. Again, I don't like the numbers are always just a little bit like they can be a little bit dubious, whether it just because you never know exactly when things are what's a situation where something could be drawn up. What's a situation where you actually had 5 seconds on the shot clock and a ball went out of bounds and it triggered a TV timeout but I mean, like the synergy numbers would be interesting to see, but I do think this is a situation where we can go like anecdotally. It was really good. So that was great. And I think we would just like to see some of the, like, okay, what made it great in what made these after timeout plays so good? Okay. We knew the strengths of the players. You knew that what the defense was expecting, and you ran counters to the defense, going to the strengths of your players to turn something into a bucket, whether it be Will Richards fading a Iverson cut screen or an Iverson cut and fading and making it essentially a rescreen. Okay, play to his ability as a catch and shoot player off movement, play to how the defense is going to read. That's great. How many back doors did we see to Riley Kugel where it's just like, I'm just stunned the team's allowed it. Riley Kugel coming in off a dribble handoff being dribble at, probably not a massive threat, yet still teams would overplay it, and it was a design backdoor. So I think you just like to see some of that leverage in the actual half court offense. And again, I think that really, like, there's so much that goes into coaching. I think a big thing about, like, if you're going to talk like in-game coaching or schematic coaching, is like you want to maximize the talent you have. And I'm just not totally sure that's what happened this year. Like, again, I said, mentioned, like, Florida's guards were incredible. Will Richard as a glue guy on the wing. Like, I think a lot of teams that went deep in the NCAA tournament would love that guy. Florida's front court rotation, mm-hmm. as even down Micah Hanlock into the tournament, next to what some of these other teams that went deep. Like, I do think that Florida's talent was mm-hmm. much better than the seed they got, and much better than zero NCAA tournament wins. So, that is more abstract. That's not like a situation of like, oh, what did, you know, what can make things like better? Oh, then, you know, maximize the talent goes into a lot of it. But I think that Florida did, like you said, I think Florida had an idea of how they wanted to play going into the year, much like they did last year. Last year, they were going to play continuity ball screen if they had 35 centers on the roster. Like, it did not matter. They were going to play continuity ball screen. So yeah. they got guys that didn't fit the system, didn't matter, played it, didn't make adjustments, and Florida had the year they did. This year, I do feel like they went in and to some extent, they backed themselves into it with roster construction, that they didn't really have power forwards, didn't have a lot of wings, so they kind of had to play two bigs. But it was like, okay, this is the style we're playing. We're going to play. And it wasn't as bad as the year prior, for sure. It's much, much improved. But I'm still not sure that it maximized Florida's players offensively. And then again, just defensively, we talked about it there could have been just much more adjustments. And I do think, like, yeah. while we talked about that, like, Florida had their base defense and didn't stray far from it. I think offensively, while they did have much better success, there's still times that we saw down the stretch, like, we saw, like, this team, like, and again, I'd actually be interested in the stats, and maybe I can look it up actually, but like, we know that by all metrics, Florida's offense was really good. But they certainly had a whole lot of scoring droughts in big moments for a team that was top 15 in a lot of adjusted metrics. Do other teams in that range have as many scoring droughts? I don't know. I'd actually be interested to go and find out. But when you're going on massive droughts, I think that that was a thing where, like, if Florida was on a drought, they just didn't have different ways to play offensively. That's like, oh, I know we haven't scored in 4 minutes doing this. Let's go to something else. They just didn't really have something else to go to. So, yeah, just the ability to change something up. The extreme way on defense would be, of course, like a zone. I know people were asking for that all year, and I just knew it was never going to come, but I didn't think it was a bad idea necessarily. I'd love to see Florida have something in their bag, like it was a zone, like just seeing how bad Florida's offense or defense was at times this year. It's like, it's hard to imagine a zone have for 15% of possessions making things worse, but you can certainly imagine it being a little bit better. So would love to see a little bit of the ability to just be pragmatic a little bit, whether it's to the roster that's recruited, to a couple weeks into the season where you have a little bit of a sample of how things are going, like just to see some ability to make some changes would be good.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Sam Weinmiller, more golden oriented, said he said, I like Neil's theory about how coaches fall somewhere on the spectrum between pragmatist and ideologue. Where do you think Golden falls on that spectrum? Are there ways he can improve by moving one direction or another? Yeah, like, so I'm really convinced of this theory. And I wish it were my theory, but it's actually a theory that Bob Bradley, the former U.S. men's national team manager, brought to my attention. And he said that he can't remember if he cribbed it from Joachim Löw, the former manager of the German national team, or a different manager, the former manager of the Spanish national team. But he said he knows that he had a conversation with one of them, and they talked about how, like, you're either a pragmatist or an ideologue, and, you know, the better you kind of can move to another direction if you have to, the better a coach you are. But you don't, you know, want to stray too far from what you're really naturally supposed to be. So, for example, like Greg Berhalter, the current U.S. coach, is definitely an ideologue. Like, he's not going to change the way that the U.S. plays. He has an idea of how he wants to play, and they're going to do that. And if players don't want to play that way, they're not going to get called in. And that's good or bad, right? And I think Todd is definitely more ideological. But I also think almost anyone was going to seem more ideological after Mike White. Like, I think Mike White was pragmatic to a fault. Like, there wasn't ever, you know, what did Rick Barnes tell me? The biggest identity of Mike White is that there is no identity. Like, you know, and I don't think Rick was trying to be, well, maybe he was trying to be a jerk, who knows? But it didn't strike me that he was trying to, I think he was trying to give me a thoughtful answer. And that's kind of the sense I get with Golden, is that it's the other way. Like, I think Golden has a way he wants to play. And Eric just mentioned it, like, year one, they were going to be continuity ball screen. Year two, they were going to play with two bigs, and they were going to have their guards win battles off the bounce, and they were going to offensive rebound, right? Last year, they didn't try to offensive rebound. Like, what did Todd say? Well, we're just not good enough defensively to try to offensive rebound. Like, everybody has to get back. And so that's kind of what they did. So I think he's definitely ideological. Like, I think they get an idea of how they want to construct a roster, and it's to a certain way that they decide they want to play, and that's what they do. And so I think we've mentioned some of the ways that I think that could improve. I think they could make certainly some adjustments defensively and get a little more, the word I use is multiple. I think they could be more multiple defensively in kind of how they attack and approach things. And I also think that, you know, maybe they could be more multiple in their half court offense too. And if that requires ultimately a staff change at some point, maybe it does. Maybe it's not a Kevin Hupday problem though. Maybe it's a Todd Golden problem. Like, I don't know. But I do think Florida sometimes, you know, when what they want to do doesn't work, there isn't often sort of a plan B that they can go to. And I'm not saying re-scrap the offense in December, like Mike White did 4 years in a row, and install something new. I'm just saying, like, have some different ideas and some different concepts of how you might want to approach things. So that would be hopefully my thoughtful answer to that question.
Yeah, that's great. I totally agree. I just, like, yeah, I don't think anyone could, I think there would really be an argument, again, just based on, like, the way that Florida has played identically on defense last 2 years. And again, the example he's offensively. And I think that the ideological side just worked a little bit better in the true high school recruiting era, where you pursued the exact guys you wanted and then you developed them the exact way you needed. I just think you're looking around the country and you're seeing that it's coaches that are a little bit more pragmatic, that are having a lot more success. And that's one of the great changes to the sport in terms of the way that it is coached. So it'll be very interesting to see the development of Golden in either of those directions.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So the next question was from Reggie Angry. Thank you for your support too, Reggie. We really appreciate you being a six-man club member. He says, what are your expectations on the projects, Cayuse and Shimmy? Do you anticipate Rishane will apply for an extra year of eligibility? So I do not think that the staff anticipates Rishane back, actually. And I think that's why there might be four spots instead of three, which I think the traditional thought was that there are three spots, Kugels, Samuels, and Pullens. I think that there are four open scholarships with Rich Wayne departed, is the understanding that I have. As for Shimmy, I don't expect much. I continue to throw out that take on the podcast, and until Alex Shimchick proves me wrong, I will continue to say I do not expect him to be a particularly impactful collegiate basketball player. Cayuse is interesting, right? Because I think there are moments there, but I also think there were a couple times when they did throw him into SEC play, and like the sheer physicality of Southeastern Conference basketball was just overwhelming to that young man. And as much as I know you guys in the Malik chat, for example, the one I'm not in, like I don't need to be invited. I'm just saying, like, there is a Malik chat. I'm aware of it. I think there's 20 of them, but I know a common thread in the Malik chat is Malik's like hero worship of Victor Lopez. And like, I think Victor's awesome. He comes on the pod all the time. I also don't think Victor Lopez can fix Cayuse in terms of like making him SEC physicality ready, like in the next 4 months. So the answer to that question for me is still like, I don't expect much from him. Like, does that mean I don't think he can be an impactful SEC player ever? I haven't decided that. I have decided that I don't think Shimchick will be. I hope I'm wrong, but that's kind of where I stand on those two guys.
Yeah. Like, again, I know I've told this story like 10 times on the podcast, but I will just say it again. Like when Shimchick committed to the Gators, I had prep coaches tell me, or post-grad coaches say, oh shoot, I thought I was going to get him on my post-grad team. So like, just to tell you, like, that's kind of the level that Shimchick was at. And I don't say that to be negative, just the fact of the matter is he was someone who was a projected guy that was going to go to a post-grad year in America. And then he was probably going to be like a low major to maybe mid-major big. So Florida took a flyer, and given when they did it with one of their last scholarships, like that's great. But like with a situation like that, you like everything needs to go right for a flyer on a player like that to work. And unfortunately he had a foot injury that is very detrimental. So like, yeah, I don't, that is like, do I see him working out the SEC? No, I think everything was going to have to work perfectly for him to be on the development curve required to be an SEC player. And I'd certainly think a foot injury, just taking him out of some very valuable time developmentally. When you're just not a super high level talent, that can be just enough to knock you off the trajectory, which again is fine. I'm sure he'll have other landing spots. It's just like the starting point with this one was not on the trajectory that he was going to be an SEC player, and everything was going to need to go right for that to happen. I don't think it has. I guess the question is just how long Florida would want to keep him around to find out. But even if that doesn't work, believe me, you're not going to hear me say like, oh, this was a waste of a scholarship, Florida. What a failed project. Like, hey, Florida took a chance with a scholarship that didn't really matter. Yeah, it's all good. I think Kais is actually really good. The question is just like, what's like, does he want to sit around and not play or go back to Lithuania, make some money that's probably less than what he could make in NIL, but like, you know, he's at home and he's playing. Like, yeah, he's a long way from home right now to sit on the bench. And Yeah. So I just like, but again, it's just one of those situations where I always use the example of like, okay, so Shimchik was like probably destined to go to a post-grad program and maybe then be a low major player. Kublegas was like at one of the, you know, one of the best teams in Europe, in Kaunas, and, you know, could probably be not playing on them this year or maybe even next year, but he's probably on their second team and, is, you know, making a tiny bit of pro money, but, is just a step away from being on, you know, the top club in Lithuania. So like, yeah, that's again, like very few freshmen you expect to come in and play at the SEC level. So it's, I don't think he's like behind or anything like that. Right. And I don't, and I think, and even if Florida were to like punt on it now, like it'd be like a little bit weird to me. Cause it's like, well, what did you expect? But hey, they get to see him in practice every day. And I don't, but, yeah, I just, I see a world where he's a very good player. So I would like to see that experiment continue, but there's also a chance that he would rather be doing something else. So that's what I'm most interested in, because if the experiment stopped, I'd be like, hey, that's, and if Florida pushed him out, I'd be like, yeah, that's kind of weird. If you're going to take a player like that, you should probably give him more, but hey, maybe they saw something and know something and it just wasn't going to work. But that is a player I would like to stick around and see what happens.
It was interesting in February when Golden said he was practicing well and like they might use him, and then they didn't, but you know, and I don't think like the Auburn game is not the fairest sample size, or the Auburn and Vanderbilt games where he like got in very briefly and like just got swallowed up by a press, like that's not terribly fair. And unfortunately, that's kind of the lasting memory that some people have. But I still think it's just for him, it's going to be a physicality issue, like at least next season. Like, doesn't mean that he can't get much stronger and really contribute, because the skill set, I think, is there. But at 6'2", 160 pounds, soaking wet, like it's just going to be tough, I think, out of the gate. And it's something to keep an eye on with Jordan Pope, by the way, is he's like pretty thin. And like he also played in the Pac-12, which isn't a terribly physical league. And it would be, I think, a little bit of adjustment. This is not a Zion Pullen type cat, right? So, you know, at least from a physical build standpoint, and that's maybe at least somewhat worth looking at. Ed Quigley, one of my favorite dudes, period, and a longtime Patreon Sixth Man Club member, said, I know you're not a recruiting podcast. Trust me, guys. I know that you don't like to do. How is UF looking in 25? Eric has mentioned to truly be great, you need top high scorers. Has the staff made inroads? Yes, they have made inroads. And I think the most important place they're making inroads is in-state, which is where Billy Donovan built a lot of his best players, best teams came from, like just winning in-state recruiting battles and like making them the foundation of his teams. Obviously Billy did real well in New York, and I think he recruited like three straight Mr. Basketballs from Tennessee, which obviously ended up helping quite a bit. One of those was Lee Humphrey, who's still the all-time leading three-point shooter in the NCAA tournament history. So good for him. You know, and Cam Spencer would have to hit, nine threes tomorrow to break Humphrey's single tournament record. So I think that's pretty safe. he's pretty good. What do I think about their, so I think they've made some inroads. They have a chance at the Boozers. They have a chance at Alex Lloyd. I think they've done well in Orlando, of course, with Kugel and Zay Brown. So, you know, they are making some inroads. I still think, and I think Eric would agree with me, that like your portal evaluations are more important. But I think you need to have the combination of both. And I don't, I agree with Eric's, I think it was a month or so ago that Eric said, we got to chill on like hitting them hard on the high school recruiting, because it's not really what you do now. It's something you want to do to build the best roster, right? Like I think Stefan Castle has proven why that's important in the NCAA tournament. Like in addition to getting Cam Spencer and maxing him out, in addition to getting Tristan Newton and maxing him out, like they had Castle like just absolutely suffocate Terrence Shannon in the Elite Eight. Right. And so like you have to win those battles. I think my hottest take has consistently been, and people have Maybe it's fair to say, hey, you just like the Westminster guy. Okay, maybe that's true, right? Maybe I just like him because he's from Westminster. I honestly think Lloyd is probably, he's as important as the Boozer Twins. I won't say he's more important because I'll try to stay super objective just because I think he can win battles off the bounce. And until this team shows that, like, they're going to be prolific at, like, running half-court stuff, you've got to bring in guards that can do that, right? And so, like, Lloyd, to me, is a guy who won't be looking at the NBA in a year or two necessarily. And I think you could have a 2 or 3 year player who can contribute as a freshman and win off the dribble. And so I think that is a huge deal. And that's a big time recruitment for Florida.
Yeah, I was actually about to ask how many years you thought Alex Lloyd was going to play in college, which certainly changes the value in my opinion. But yeah, like, it's very clear. Like, yeah, you need NBA talent to win. And like, hey, like, Dalton Knecht is an amazing story. There's just not too many of those guys out there. And then, like, hey, Florida hit 2 home runs, or I'll say a home run and a double, triple. I don't know what you want to say for Tyree Samuel. It was obviously very good. I think calling that a home run would be a little rich, but I think Zion Pullen was an absolute home run. I think you nailed Tyree Samuel, and it's like, oh, and those guys are gone, and you're back to the drawing board, and it's unlikely you're going to be able to hit that same level of production from the 2 guys that you're going to get to replace them. So it's, yeah, it's at some point you need kind of multiple year guys, usually NBA talent, if you're going to win at the highest level. Like, maybe you get around a little bit by getting the guys like Will Richard, but then again, like, I always love Will Richard. I think that NBA draft Twitter, who likes to throw 500 darts a year, and then when they hit on 20 of them, flex. And again, I love draft Twitter, but oh my, like, they cast extremely, extremely wide nets. And then when they're right on one of the 75 sleepers they picked, it looked great. So yeah, there's a lot of NBA draft people that said after his year at Belmont that this was an NBA player. I mean, maybe, but again, that's, Will Richard has been fantastic. I'm not sure he's going to be the first. I'm not sure he's going to be the first or second or maybe even third best player on a Final Four team. So yeah, again, it's just like, look at those guys, where they came from, around the Final Four, around the Elite Eight, second weekend. That's not to say it's 100% guys recruited out of high school. Hey, I would take, give me a Jordan Sears anytime, multiple years of that. That's great. But still, well, yeah, I just, like, you still look at the highest level dudes. They still come from the high school level. While of course the portal is super important. And usually these NBA guys that are recruited are supported by high level portal guys. But so that's where you look at guys that are high level talents that could be in college for 2 or 3 years. Suddenly they become very important. I don't know enough to agree or refute your claim, but it seems like the Boozers are probably going to be one and done no matter what happens. And like, no matter how their freshman season goes. And those are the guys that can get you fired. That can be interesting. Like, just looking at recent years, guys that were just destined to be one and done, no matter what their freshman season was like, those have not historically been great for college basketball programs. I mean, if they're really good, then, like, yeah, it obviously looks awesome, and you'd still want a one and done NBA talent if they're going to score, 15 a game and be elite. Those takes always do scare me just a little bit, because you just never know if someone's going to struggle a little bit. Average 9-2, doesn't matter. They're going to the league on potential anyways.
Yeah, no. And I think Lloyd is 2 in a best case scenario for Alex, probably a 3-year college player. And I think impactful, right? Like, he could be that freshman that averages 8 points a game, but has that game or two as a freshman where he scores 15 or 16 and is a huge difference maker in why you win. And, he's the kind of guy that you got to have a top 50 player like that. I mean, look, for example, Jaren Stevenson just is part of why Alabama just went to the Final Four, right? Like, without him, they do not win the North Carolina game. They just don't. But that happened to be one of the games where he was really marvelous. Rylan Griffin too, for that matter. But Stevenson may be a better example, because he's, like, with Lloyd in that top 30 player category, right? Rylan Griffin, I think, is top 75 player, So really good, but still, I mean, you gotta have vision. You gotta be able to flesh out both of those things in order to win. Michael Pusatara, another guy who has been, Jacob M asked about Jordan Pope and how he would potentially fit. And Mike Rosario asked about JP Pegues and how we liked his game. And Rosie said, we already know he's a March Madness dog. So we always appreciate when former players, we have a couple right now that subscribe, which is awesome. And Jacob, everybody knows him from Twitter. So any thoughts on Pegues since we talked to Pope earlier?
Yeah, Pegues, who's got a visit to Florida planned, would be the best guard on Florida's board right now, in my opinion. Again, we can probably go deeper another time. But yeah, I think that you played a Furman team that is just notorious for running very good offense. They run a lot of Princeton. So what I like about Pegues as well is that he's very good as a ball screen player. He's also very good away from the ball. And that's, again, what Florida could maybe use a little bit more of, is that they had some impactful guys everywhere. And I think that the only one who was really good without the ball was Walter Clayton. And again, it's just like one of those situations where, like, hey, Zion Pullen was great, but like, he's always been a player who's best with the ball in his hands. And that's what he does. Tyre Samuel, best with the ball in his hands, didn't really contribute a lot elsewhere. I guess, you know, Will Richards, someone who's a good catch and shoot player, doesn't bring a lot of juice off the dribble or attacking a closeout. But like, yeah, Pegues, like, really good, as a kind of coming off screens guy, really good as someone who sets screens and can slip and cut. And yeah, just like a very mature game. I think that the big knock on him will just be like the fact that he's like 6'1" and like 185 pounds.
Right.
So yeah, he's certainly not your prototypical elite athlete. I don't think he's got the, like, I'll say Zion Pullen or Walter Clayton flash. It's hard for me to imagine him scoring 17 points a game or whatever these, you know, Walter Clayton and Zion Pullen were. But I think he's a guy who's like, your good outcome for him is like 13 points a game, like 5 assists, low turnover, and someone that just helps you in a lot of other ways, because he is someone who's moves the ball really intelligently, really good cutter. Like, not that he's going to like finish a bunch of backdoor cuts on layups, but like, we'll keep the floor balanced, like knows when to move and open up lanes for his teammate. So just a very intelligent guard. And that would be, yeah, I know that Pope is probably the sexier name. I would prefer Pegues personally.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And I love that Rosario mentioned the shot against Virginia, because the other thing is, like, I do think JP Pegues is tough. Like, you know, he was, I think, 2 of, I don't know, I had looked the other day. He was 2 of 8 or 3 of 8 or 3 of 9 in that game. Hadn't really made a lot of shots. Was 0 for 3 from beyond the arc, and still just kind of stepped up and calmly made that shot. And, like, I think Zion Pullen brought Florida some toughness, just mental toughness this season that helped benefit the Gators in a bunch of games. And I do think JP Pegues certainly brings that. And for those that, like, are critical of, you know, maybe bringing a player from a losing program, like Pope, playing for a coach that, you know, but for an Elite Eight season that came kind of out of nowhere thanks to a lottery pick, would not be at Oregon State anymore. And some people think shouldn't still be there. So anyway, you know, Jordan Pope hasn't done a lot of winning. JP Pegues certainly has. Also played, Eric mentioned, for Bob Rishi, one of the most, you know, good, one of the better offensive minds in the sport. So I think, you know, that's always just having somebody that has an understanding of how to play and an understanding of how to win certainly makes him an appealing player in my mind. Michael Pusatara asked about roster spots and construction for next year. He says, it appears with Brown and Ryu coming, there might only be 2 scholarship spots left. So I think there's 4. I mentioned, I think Rich Wayne is departed, which opens up the 4th. He says, if you go after Pegues, then you need a front court player in the portal. And who do you think is the best of the current targets that Florida is looking for in the portal? And then what do you think Florida needs to have a roster that could play in the second weekend? Well, I think they had a roster that could play in the second weekend. They just didn't get to the second weekend. So that would be my first answer. Like, I think Florida was certainly good enough to go to the second weekend. I still think they could have beaten Marquette had they played them. We saw them dominate a team that was in the Final Four twice in March. So we know that, like, they were capable of playing really well. But, you know, referees and then 18 consecutive possessions without a stop, and they go home in the round of 64. So I think they're on the right track from an evaluation and roster construction standpoint, to be honest. I do think that we can overestimate a leap that a player is going to take, like we all did with Riley Kugel. And I, you know what? I say we all, except for Eric. I'm actually going to stick up for Eric here because I listened to some of these pods over. And I remember Eric saying, well, what happens if Kugel, you know, if his flaws end up, Eric's like, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I am saying it's possible when you watch the film. And remember, he dropped a Patreon video as well to our Patreons. Good reason to subscribe. And he pointed out some concerns he had while also pointing out that he has breathtaking talent. Well, he has breathtaking talent. Otherwise, he doesn't land at Kansas, where they desperately needed players who can create off the dribble like Riley Kugel. Like, that is why he's going there, is to get downhill like he was asked to do at Florida and rejected ball screen after ball screen and refused to do. And then he didn't finish, and Bill Self has a lot of Final Four banners that make him believe he can fix Riley Kugel's finishing at the rim, right? Like, I don't want to digress, though. The point I'm making, in addition to just pumping up Eric a little bit, because I think he deserves it on that, is I do think Alex Condon takes a significant leap. I think it's more safe to suggest that Alex Condon takes a leap than it was in hindsight to say Riley Kugel will take a leap. So, like, I think Florida gets a bump from Kugel. So I think they can be particularly selective in what kind of front court player they look at, even though Micah Hanlockton is not likely to contribute much next season, if at all. And I think what they need is somebody that can help anchor the team better defensively, right? Whether that's Amari Williams. I think that's why they didn't really get in on the Townsend kid from Oakland. Whether or not you think that's a mistake, I get, but like Sam Alexis is another guy who I think offers a little more on the defensive side, not on the Amari Williams level, but like, so I get that those are guys that they're targeting, and that's kind of where I think they're leaning in the front court. If the early sort of tea leaves are indicative of what the broader plan is.
Yeah. I've heard some things that Amari Williams, who has Florida fourth in his list of visits, is not going to get to Gainesville. So we'll see if that happens, but he is definitely the top target for me of he's the best player, the best front court player that Florida has looked at. Again, I think like one of the things that like seemed to bring me some annoyance, but like didn't seem to bother the general Florida fan, was the fact that like Florida built their team to play two centers at all times, yet got absolutely bullied by like mid-major centers. Like, again, it's just like, if you're going to play a bunch of centers, like maybe get guys that aren't going to like, again, I kind of said before, like they like kind of set position themselves that they wanted to play bully ball and then got no bullies. Like Amari Williams is like legit size at 6'10", 260 pounds. He is someone who has just like been one of the best defensive rebounders in the country. The last 3 years, he's been 18th, 6th, and 28th. In defensive rebounding rate, as a shot blocker in shots blocked, or block rate is the right way to say that, he's 32nd, 38th, and 39th. And then like his 2-point percentage has been very good, because all he does is post up and score. Doesn't score a lot, but this is someone who has just had like three solid productive seasons at Drexel. They are 126th in KenPom, so I mean, like, hey, this isn't like an elite big playing in the CAA. It wasn't like they were like loaded with like big men, so we certainly had a good size advantage, but this is just a very like high floor kind of situation at center. And it's someone who's going to rebound at a super high level, defend. He's really good at guarding in pick and roll, can absolutely play the drop coverage that Florida has wanted to, as previously discussed. And someone that like won't need the ball thrown into him a whole bunch in the block, which might actually like help Florida's offense not have a guy like that. So I think that Amari Williams is certainly the top guy on Florida's board, but for, you know, that means he's also going to be the top of the other team's boards. And Florida's got last visit. I know that people always ask, like, oh, is it good to be the first visit? Is it good to be the last? Like, I don't really like, I think it can, it's just different case to case, but some people think that he's going to be elsewhere, not make it to Gainesville. I think this is someone who Florida, if they have an opportunity to, this should be the guy. And again, we'll still see, this isn't like, not everyone's in the portal that's going to be, but if Florida ended up with Williams at center, I think that would be a pretty good outcome.
I think it would too. I wanted to say that I do like Sam Alexis, the Chattanooga player, quite a bit. I know that he recently listed Florida, Georgia, Providence. And by the way, can we asterisk Georgia on this recruiting battle as to why some other interesting things may in fact be circulating outside on certain message boards that you all may have heard about or may not. But I would say that when you're in intense recruiting battles with Georgia, and Georgia is trying to win their first NCAA tournament game in two decades, they may be prone to, you know, saying a thing or two that may have less foundation in truth than reality. Who knows? But let's get into Sam Alexis. And I'm having some fun tonight, just trying to drop Easter eggs, Eric. So Sam Alexis, the kid from Chattanooga, reminds me a lot of Luka Brockovic, who was an all A-10 player at Davidson. And he was on a really good Davidson team that just they almost beat Tom Izzo in the first round. That's how good they were. they had a guy from Korea who I think Fawcett loved, who could really shoot. They had Fletcher Lawyer's brother, Foster Lawyer. They had a bunch of dudes, man. They were good. And Brockovic was kind of like the defensive anchor for them. He was a guy who blocked shots. He's a guy who crushed the glass. He's a guy who you didn't really want to shoot a three, but like he made more than 10 of them. And it wasn't like all of them off the backboard a la Micah Hanlockton. Like if he was open, he could, you know, Aaron Bradshaw his way to a triple in a key moment. And so I like him. I like his game a lot. He was a top 100 guy in offensive rebounding, a top 50 guy in defensive rebounding, a top 40 guy in block percentage. He was really high in effective field goal percentage. And he did so on a Chattanooga team that I think won a bunch of games. Yeah, they won 21 games, did not get invited to the CBI or the NIT, but they did win 21 times. And, you know, that league is not great. That they play in. So, you know, certainly would be an adjustment. It's not as good as the league that Amari Williams played in, for example. But I think he'd have multiple years of eligibility, which I think is probably appealing if the staff gets the jump from Conn they think they're going to get. They might not have Alex for a whole lot longer. And then the other thing about Alexis is he's from Florida. He's an Apopka kid. So he grew up playing with Walt Clayton and some of those guys in the AAU circuit, Denzel Aberdeen. So a lot of kind of tea leaves there suggest to me that Florida will get him. I think if they get him, they're going to need to complement him with someone else. But I do think he would be a nice fit, and he certainly would make Florida better defensively.
Yeah, that's just one of those things. And I know we keep talking about it, but like you just got incredible contributions from Zion Pullen and Tyre Samuel, who are going out the door. So it's like if those guys are Alexis and Pegues, I mean, those are two good players, but like are those as good as the two guys you just that just left the building and you lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament? Like when I see Alexis, I think that's certainly an intriguing player and moves really well. And has great length, and it's just one of those things where like I just don't see him as someone who's going to be a super impactful player right away, which is okay in some settings, but like Florida needs some impact guys. If like again, you've got like I think that they were loaded with talent this year, couldn't win a game in the NCAA tournament. If you're not going to match that talent, what is there to suggest that suddenly this team is going to push for a second weekend. Like so yeah, that'll be interesting. And even Amari Williams, who I think is really, really good. I think that like conceptually that really would help, because I could see a situation where like, is Florida, like, I don't think Florida's offense is that much worse if like he's on the floor, because it's not like they got a lot from their centers. But their defense would have been a lot better with him. So at least there'd be some improvement there. But it's one of those things that like, if it was like a Pegues, Williams, Alexis, maybe something else, upcoming wing class, like you can still feel pretty good about it. But at the same time, it's like, you've still got to look at it and say like, okay, is this talent that much better than a team that just had a fairly embarrassing performance in the first round? No, I shouldn't say fairly embarrassing, but there's a world where they lose that game by like 15, took a pretty remarkable Walter Clayton run to make it such a respectable game where they certainly could have won. But that'll be interesting for sure. But I do think that we have mentioned now the guys that all have visits planned to Florida, some as soon as the 12th of April. So yeah, I might start to hear some news soon.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned Jonathan Bogbo, who declared for the NBA draft and didn't enter the portal yet. To me, like, the biggest problem there is like that he didn't enter the portal. Like, so I can't really analyze that. Now, that if he did enter the portal, I think he would go to Florida. I really do. And like, I think that would be the kind of player that would be monstrous, but hasn't happened yet. So can't dive too deep into that. Certainly, I know that there's a lot of people who think he's going to get pretty positive feedback and stay in the draft anyway. But we will see. How that ends up. That is all of the Patreon questions and the end of our show for tonight. But we appreciate all of our Patreons. Thank you guys so much for everything that you've done this year to just kind of help out Eric and I. We have a lot of fun talking about this sport with you. So we appreciate it. And I'll let Eric sign us off.
Go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.